Welcome to the Mikey Pod on the Bayou Show. Yeehaw.
That's not what this show's about.
It ain't.
No. Here, watch this. Welcome to Mikey Pod on the Bayou. Texas, it's not just for cow-tipping rednecks.
Well, hello. Welcome to Mikey Pod on the Bayou. This is episode number 39. I'm getting close to 40. Interesting. Today, I am so excited about what I have for you. First part of an interview I did this morning with Kathy Kelly. Who is Kathy Kelly, you may ask? Well, I discovered her in an interview in Sun Magazine, which, as you may know, is one of my two favorite magazines in the universe. Perhaps even... whatever. Anyway, I read an interview with her, and I find it extremely inspiring. She is a three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee. She's the founder of Voices in the Wilderness, which is an organization that is devoted to break the economic sanctions the UN and U.S. have on Iraq. And she has been to Iraq numerous times, which you'll hear about. And I'm just so excited that she was willing to be interviewed. So that is coming up right after this. Something else I'm excited about. One of my three favorite people, as you know, I should have a quiz on this. Jane Sibri, Yoko Ono, and David Sylvian. David Sylvian's record label has given me permission to play his music. And one of the songs that he did with Ryuichi Sakamoto is called World Citizen, and I think it's perfect as an introduction for today's show. And, well, here it is.
There goes one baby's life. It's such a small amount. She's an American. I guess it doesn't count. 6,000 children's lives were simply thrown away. Lost without medicine. Inside of 30 days in the New York Harbor, where the stocks withheld, it was the price we paid for a safer world. World is suffering. World is suffering. World is suffering. World citizen. And the buildings fall in a cloud of dust, and we ask ourselves, how could they hate us? Well, when we live in ignorance and luxury, while our superpowers practice puppet mastery, we raise the men who run the fascist states, and we sell them on. So they maintain their place. We turn our backs on the things they've done, their human rights record and the guns they run. His world is suffering. Her world is suffering. Their world is suffering. World citizen. My world is suffering. Your world is suffering. Our world is suffering. World citizen. Who'll do away with flags? Who'll do us proud? Remove the money from their pockets. Scream dissent out loud. 'Cause God ain't on our side. The shoe won't fit. And though they think the one that's not the last of it. Disenfranchised people need their voices heard, and if no one stops to listen, lose their faith in words. And violence rises when all hope is lost. Who'll embrace the human spirit and absorb the cost? Suffering, her world is suffering, their world is suffering world citizens. Our world is suffering. Your world is suffering. Our world is suffering. World citizens.
That's David Sylvian and Ryuichi Sakamoto with World Citizen. Did you listen to the words? That was my first time to listen to those words since I had this conversation with Kathy Kelly this morning. And it's a lot more poignant to me at this point. So maybe once, if you didn't listen so closely to the words, once you hear the interview, go back and listen again. I think it's almost spooky how much in line they are with the conversation you're about to hear. Like I said, the conversation was long. We talked for about an hour or so. So I'm going to split it into two parts. And we got interrupted twice. Skype and my internet connection just decided to stop. So Kathy, again, I apologize for that. And I thank you for your patience. I want to say a little about the editing I did. Part of this process of doing this podcast for me has really been to sort of begin the journey to find my own voice. And I'm accepting the fact that that means that I'm not always going to sound the way I want to. So I gave in a little bit on the editing of this and edited out some of my ums and my stammers when I was just at a loss. Because I've said it countless times on this show that I haven't paid attention to things for a long time. And learning them and learning about the horrors that are committed in the world sometimes just stops me in my tracks. And yeah, well, that's that. So I'm just hoping that my process of learning and my willingness, I guess, to do it publicly will be helpful to maybe people who are in the same position as me and perhaps give you the courage to look as much like a jackass as sometimes I feel like I do. So without further ado, here's the first half of my interview with Kathy Kelly from Voices in the Wilderness. Okay, I'm here with Kathy Kelly, the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign to end the UN-US sanctions against Iraq. She's also the author of the book Other Lands Have Dreams. Thanks for joining us today, Kathy.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a privilege to be with you.
Can you tell us a little about Voices in the Wilderness and how it came about?
Well, Voices in the Wilderness was a campaign that began in 1996 after a number of people began to be very aware, mostly through the eyewitness accounts of two elderly Roman Catholic sisters, that the war in Iraq hadn't really ended. The 1990 invasion of Kuwait by Iraq had caused the United States to decide to go to war against Iraq in 1991. And that was a military bombardment wherein the United States clearly attained a quick victory and routed Iraq's troops out of Kuwait, and in fact could have probably put Saddam Hussein out of office if the U.S. had chosen to do so then. But what instead was chosen was a continuation of economic sanctions, which in the eyes of many, including myself, never really punished Saddam Hussein in any way of depriving him of meals or comforts or security for himself. But rather, these economic sanctions directly punished people who couldn't control Saddam Hussein. I'm thinking especially of children under age 5. And they punished them not, you know, with a slap on the wrist, but these children were being grotesquely tortured to death. Because when children die from waterborne diseases and starvation, that's really the best way to describe it, a grotesque and a tortuous preliminary experience to dying. And these kids never committed any crime. So after these sisters had gone there repeatedly and talked about going to hospitals and seeing deplorable conditions and talked about being with people in poor areas who couldn't get adequate food or clean water. A number of us thought, well, we were in Iraq either before or during or immediately after that first war with a peace team or with efforts to secure release of hostages or with efforts to report on the consequences of the war. You know, it was all very easy for us to come back and say, well, okay, now the war has ended. But we were troubled, and we realized it didn't end, that we just decided to go on with our lives and kind of forget about Iraq. So we thought, well, what would it do? What would it take to focus people's attention in the United States on a clear and a very grievous injustice? And we thought, well, we could mount a nonviolent campaign where we would take any risk or harm on ourselves, try not to cause harm to others, and do that by violating the United States law, which prohibited any transaction, any delivery of any goods by United States people to people in Iraq. And the sanctions were so comprehensive that Iraq's oil revenue couldn't be used to buy any needed goods. And really, Iraq formerly had imported 90% of its pharmaceuticals and 70% of its food. So without being able to use their oil revenues to buy what they needed, by the time 1996 came along, people were suggesting that as many as 587,000 children under age 5 might have already died. Now, who could do the number crunching and the statistics adequate to lay out what had really happened? We didn't know. But suppose that, you know, only a tiny fraction of that number had died. You don't punish children for political reasons.
Right. I read in the in your article, what about the incubators, that children that were not able to be taken care of at all, like even the most basic medical needs, were just not there.
It was certainly true that Dr. Kusai al-Rahim, in a hospital, he was a kind of like everybody's favorite pediatrician, a very kindly man, and he described how an intern of his had thought that he might successfully repair an incubator, and people in the hospital were still feeling great chagrin because it wasn't a successful repair attempt, and they put the child in the incubator, but the child couldn't survive. And so he would start to tell mothers, look, you know, try to simulate conditions of an incubator, holding your child between your breasts and wrap yourself with a blanket and your abaya. And the abaya is the heavy covering that people wear, women wear. And this doctor had been at the bedsides of hundreds of little children whom he, in his earlier years as a doctor, could readily have saved with medicines, with proper equipment, with decent conditions in a hospital, and with some confidence that the children would go back and they'd have access to clean water and food in their own homes. But it was horrendous, really, for people in hospitals to stand by helplessly and not be able to get just the simple life-saving goods that were needed, like oral rehydration kits for children or blood bags or units to collect blood or any of the surgical implements that were needed, antibiotics, anesthetics. All of these were being denied because Iraq didn't have the revenue to buy these things. And maybe Saddam Hussein, if he'd had more revenue, wouldn't have immediately made those purchases. But if Iraq hadn't been so isolated, if it hadn't been so cut off from the rest of the world, if people hadn't made it sound as though Saddam Hussein was the only person living there, then I think that the world would not have allowed those children to suffer as grievously as they did.
We're not really told about that aspect of political sanctions in our media, which seems to sugarcoat or just leave out so much of these important things about the real people who are affected by the war and by those sanctions.
Well, it does trouble me a great deal that for the many, many delegations that went over to Iraq, 70 in all, just with Voices in the Wilderness, and then eventually many other peace groups started to send delegations, the Fellowship of Reconciliation and Pax Christi and Vets for Peace, that when we come back to the United States, we could certainly tell our neighbors and our family members and small groups in church basements or in community halls what we'd seen and heard, and we could show slides and we could tell anecdotes, but you could not get the mainstream media to pay attention. And I suppose one of the most troubling examples of that was in August of 1999, when Carol Bellamy, who headed UNICEF, held a press conference. And at that press conference, she announced why it was that a UNICEF study believed they could confidently state that 500,000 children under age 5 had died and that the economic sanctions had contributed directly toward their deaths, and that UN workers didn't want to keep imposing these sanctions. You know, the UN was founded to eliminate the scourge of warfare, not to be used as an agent to punish and kill children. And she laid it all out in a very articulate press conference, and there was a very lengthy document that they submitted. And do you know how much coverage there was for that press conference in the mainstream press? One half of one sentence in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, this is very, very indicative of how little people cared what was happening to people in Iraq. And yet, you know, as soon as you said, well, we have to get rid of this evil dictator, we owe it to the people in Iraq, and therefore we're going to mobilize a huge army, and we're going to drop 5,000-pound bombs on their cities and towns, and we're going to make an invasion and then leave their borders open so that anybody else can come in with anything else they want. We're going to have a very inept and badly managed program for development afterwards. I mean, where is the compassion, I have to wonder, for average, ordinary Iraqis? And right now, where's the compassion for these young 18-year-olds who are being sent over there to die? Now, I think 2,400, close to that number, have died, and so many more. Well over 15,000 have come back maimed or with post-traumatic stress disorders or blinded. And it seems that marketed this war because of hyperinflated fears that they were able to develop within the United States. Saddam was linked to Al-Qaeda. That wasn't true. Saddam was responsible for 9/11. There's simply no evidence. Or Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, they just couldn't come up with any of the 37 items of evidence that Colin Powell laid out when he made a speech before the United Nations of indications that Iraq had these weapons of mass destruction. When Iraq was open for inspection and the United States inspection teams went in, they couldn't get scientists inside Iraq to say, yes, this is what we couldn't tell you under Saddam, now we're free to tell you. There wasn't anybody to tell anything about that. They couldn't find these big factories full of centrifuge machines that they claimed were there. Where were all the trucks with many documents that were supposed to be going across the country, dodging the weapons inspectors? Where was all this equipment? They just said, well, we were wrong. It wasn't there. And then went to war against Iraq because we could, I think, because we knew that they couldn't fight back.
I read about your interaction with the American soldiers while you were in Baghdad in that interview in the Sun magazine. Can you tell us what that experience was like? It seemed like most of the soldiers you encountered were not really in support of the war.
Well, that maybe would be saying a bit too much, Michael. What I can say is that over the first 10 days of the occupation, as the soldiers arrived right at the intersection where we were living in a hotel throughout the bombing, I never heard a crude word or a rude word from the Marines that occupied that intersection. What I did hear were many expressions on the part of Marines about how they wished they could be part of rebuilding, how they'd really like to be part of reconstruction, how they were sorry for suffering caused in the past, and they wanted to better understand what had been going on. Why were people in Iraq in such a bad situation? They said they could see that these were good people and decent people and innocent people. And I think that you know, many of those Marines had gone through very horrific battles where they didn't know who they were necessarily shooting at. When they'd go into a farmhouse and they might see fatigues lying on the ground, they might panic and think, well, this is a military place. And by one soldier's account, they just started shooting everybody in sight. They had certainly, many of them, been congratulating one another, according to an embedded reporter who traveled with them, when they'd have their first kill or when they'd survive a big battle. So I don't want to say that these were unarmed peacekeepers that entered into Baghdad, but I do believe that most of these young, primarily young people, would have liked nothing better than to roll up their sleeves and be about the work of trying to help create purified water systems and create better electrical systems, help with healthcare delivery. But I have to say, when they arrived in Baghdad, They didn't have a map of the clinics and hospitals in Iraq. The only building that the military was assigned to protect was the oil ministry, and they were camped outside of our hotel, feeling a bit idle. That's why they had time to come and talk to us. And I think they felt badly. I think that they represent a generation in the United States that would love nothing better than to be trained and equipped to go out and do things in the world that would help to offset the terrible privation and inadequacies in terms of caring for people that exist in many, many, many parts of the world. And instead, we put $437 billion of our wealth and productivity into funding people to learn how to pull triggers, drop bombs, aim guns, and use threat and force and repression to solve problems. Well, eventually, I think for a number of reasons, it wasn't difficult for the insurgent groups to reclaim weapons. They knew where these weapons were stashed. They started to go and get those weapons. There wasn't anyone to stop them. And violence began to go in an upward direction very quickly in terms of Iraqis attacking other Iraqis. The embassy, the Jordanian embassy was attacked. The Red Cross building was attacked. There were quickly hostages taken. And I think that, you know, for the United States not to have guessed that this would happen was a terrible oversight. Or perhaps, I mean, some very cynical people suggest that the United States knew this would happen and wanted it to happen, because the more that Iraq would be destabilized and chaotic, the more it would be possible to insist, well, the United States has to build bases and maintain a strong military presence. I don't know. I honestly have no way of knowing what was in the minds of the people that were behind the planning of this horrific warfare and invasion. But I certainly know that I can read the report that was just put out by the Iraq's reconstruction general. It's a report that the United States put out, and it tells that on every level of measuring, whether it's literacy, healthcare delivery, clean water, the ability to get a job or to get electricity, Iraqis are worse off than they were before the United States came in.
And there doesn't seem to be any sign of anything improving anytime soon, from what I can tell.
Well, not as long as the U.S. public seems to be so reticent about contacting Congress people and expressing dissatisfaction with the war. I think a lot of people in polls will say, yeah, yeah, we don't like the idea of this war. We don't want U.S. troops to go over there anymore. We think it was a mistake. But people, for some reason, according to the congressional people in D.C., are not calling their Congress people. The Friends Committee on National Legislation has told us that they go and knock on the doors of Congress people and say, hey, here are statistics, here are critiques, here are reports, and the Congress people's aides are saying, well, we're not hearing from our constituents. And I'm not sure why that is, but I do believe it's crucial, it's vitally important that people who have feelings about this war make sure that their elected representative knows about those feelings. I think a lot of times people feel like, well, okay, I'll go to a demonstration, I'll hold a sign, I'll stand outside, and that's good, that's important. Or I'll go to an education event, and that's important. But I think it's right now quite vital that those views be made known to elected representatives, because they're now ready to vote on yet another appropriations bill that would add $65 billion of more military procurement aid to the troops in Iraq. And I think congressional representatives think, well, we've got to support our troops. But this is digging in and entrenching and keeping the troop presence there by funding so much military development. And if you look at that particular bill, it only requests 1/65th of the total sum for anything to do with construction in Iraq. Most of that would be to maintain things that have been constructed, and the new construction would amount to 10,000 prison beds that are designated as being one project the U.S. would undertake in Iraq, creating 10,000 new prison beds.
I'm glad that you said that about calling senators and that sort of thing, because one of the things I wanted to ask you, or I think that part of what happens is that I know personally it's hard for me not to first like put the blinders on and just sort of pretend that this isn't happening. And also it feels there's a sense of sort of helplessness for me, and I think for a lot of other people who, and it's hard to get past that and take some sort of action. I think that's a lot of why people aren't doing anything. So, like, as far as, do you feel like letter writing is the most important thing that people can do?
Well, not only letter writing, but also calling and visiting elected representatives. I mean, 8 people in Chicago undertook a 34-day electricity fast, and they'll be finishing it up on March 24th. And they go to work. Several are teachers and social workers, and they do their normal daytime jobs and use electricity. But whenever they're not at their jobs, they are dedicated to going without electricity for these 34 days because they want to try and identify with people in Iraq who really have no choice, who have gone for many, many years now with outages. They say in Baghdad now an average amount of electricity is 2 to 4 hours a day. So, you know, these young people are helping us imagine what's it like to be operating by candlelight without refrigerators, not able to use cell phones, forget about TV. If your heat is dependent on electricity, then you're going to be cold in the winter weather in Baghdad and without air conditioning or air coolers in the intense hot summers. There's a lot of misery and frustration that happens. It's difficult for hospitals to function. The traffic lights don't work. I mean, I think that the notion that security in Iraq only is related to ammunition and bullets and helicopters with guns mounted on the base so that they could get superior air force, training people to be able to shoot at other people. It's a false notion. A lot of the security that people need is the ability to get a job and feed your family, the assurance that you'd be able to get anesthetics or antibiotics if your child is in pain or sick, the security that comes with knowing that there's a possibility to just get the basic food. But what's happened is that the World Bank and the IMF have agreed that Iraq is now responsible for $125 billion of Saddam Hussein's debts that he rang up when he bought weapons, a lot of military equipment from other countries, and used that against his own people. Why should the people in Iraq today be responsible for that? You would think that the World Bank and the IMF would be told by the U.S. government and by the United Nations, look, tell those creditors they're going to have to wait. If they were dumb enough to sell weapons to Saddam Hussein or to sell other materials to shore up Saddam Hussein's dictatorship, they're just going to have to wait to get paid back at least until Iraq gets back on its feet, or perhaps not be paid back at all. But instead, Iraq has now been subjected since December 23rd to an austerity measure such that in order to begin paying back that debt, subsidies that were given to poor people to get cooking fuel, to get petrol for transportation, have been cut back. The prices then rose threefold. They're expected to rise tenfold by the end of the year. I mean, can you imagine the misery and the frustration people are feeling? They just get pelted and belted one trauma after another. And that is, I mean, if even a fourth of that happened to any city in the United States, in terms of the sanctions and the bombing and the occupation and the invasion and the lack of any kind of planning and then this new economic warfare that's being waged against them, don't you imagine cities would be rising up in violent chaos and saying, we won't put up with this? Well, we've got a horrendous situation now in Iraq. People pushed to the brink of civil war.
See, it's so overwhelming in a way to sort of to follow that, you know.
Michael, I think in a way it's overwhelming, but I think it's also very, very true that the average U.S. person takes one-third of his or her income and turns that over to the Defense Department. Now, where do those monies go in terms of warfare in Iraq? I'll name some companies, very wealthy companies, Halliburton, Kellogg Brown & Root, Bechtel. Just those three companies are making a lot of profit as long as the war and the chaos in Iraq continues, because they're the ones that do much of the logistical support for the army, and they're the ones who are getting the privatized contracts to develop Iraq's oil in the future. Iraq's oil revenues would maybe someday be paying for those countries to continue, but right now the United States is making contract after contract with those companies and also with Boeing and General Electric and Westinghouse and Alliant Tech and Raytheon. I mean, they even ran out of bullets over in Iraq and had to import some from Israel. So the weapon makers who constitute the largest lobby on Capitol Hill, are telling elected representatives, look, don't vote against the war, because if you do, we're going to put a lot of money into the election campaign mounted by your opponent. And then the American-Israeli Political Action Committee is the second strongest lobby on Capitol Hill. And they're also saying, look, don't vote for the United States troops to leave Iraq because we don't want Israel to be left undefended. And meanwhile, for 38 years, the United States taxpayers have paid $100 million toward developing Israel's defense forces. And Israel now has 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons. This destabilizes the region tremendously, and Israel has never acknowledged that it has the weapons, has never let the International Atomic Energy Association come in and investigate its weapons or find out how much it has. And the United States just stonewalls and says, well, that's not something we can even say a word about. So, yeah, people in the Arab and the Muslim world feel great frustration. They have grievances. Instead of pouring money into more bombs and bullets and weapon systems, why not ask, well, what are those grievances? Why not try to understand why would people be angry and furious and plan revenge and plan retaliation? I don't think anybody should pick up a weapon ever, but I sure want to ask that question. Why? Wouldn't that make more sense? And then if you find out that a large part of the grievance is that people feel that tremendous injustice has been done to them, that they can't get clean water and they can't get food and they can't get jobs because their precious and irreplaceable resources are being controlled by outside forces, well, why not say, look, we're going to quit doing that. We're not going to try to control or dominate your oil. We're going to close down the bases that we built over there. We're going to start bringing our troops home and put that money that we were going to direct into military occupation into helping the United Nations develop a protective presence composed of a multinational force of countries who would go in unarmed but help to secure a peace in Iraq such that people could start to resume something like normalcy.
It seems so easy and obvious, but it must not be to our leaders.
Well, again, I think I just want to emphasize that the two strongest lobbies on Capitol Hill are the defense lobby and the American-Israeli Political Action Commission. So people can't run bake sales to mount their campaigns. They feel very, very intimidated by those great lobbies. Now, also ask yourself, who owns NBC, General Electric? Who owns CBS, Westinghouse? So as long as you've got these major weapon contractors owning the media, then turn to the education systems and see how many universities are getting big research grants from major weapon-producing companies. So the universities are afraid to speak up. Then look at how many Reserve Officer Training Corps, ROTC, facilities are on campuses of universities across the country. Now, it's just amazing because people, many average ordinary people think, wow, in those Muslim lands, people send their children to these madrasas and they're training young people to be terrorists. Well, 15% of the madrasas in Pakistan, for instance, have any kind of military training at all, but we've got military training going in our high schools and our colleges all across this country, and we have a military budget that's larger than the military budgets combined of the countries that President Bush designated as the axis of evil.
I read that you're a war tax resister. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I'm a war tax refuser. I refuse to pay. I think a lot of people resist it, but they pay because they really are not in a position where they feel that they could be responsible to their families or their jobs or their everyday life needs without compromising their principles and saying, okay, I don't want to do this, but I'm going to pay my taxes, even though I know that well over 40% is going toward weapons. But I can't do that. I just can't. So I've been lucky, really lucky. I've been able to arrange my life so that any time that I was working for wages, I either lowered my salary beneath the taxable income, or I'd claim extra allowances on the W-4 form, or I would, for many 7 years, I took care of my father, and it was his Social Security and pension that paid the rent here. I mean, I've been lucky, and I think the IRS has written me off as uncollectible. But I think it's something that people can't do lightly. You have to really study the issues and go to a website called NUTREC, National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, and get from that website lots of information about both the issues and also what would be practical ways to go about war tax refusal. But I think it's important that people at least realize that we all have in our personal budgets, as long as we're paying any kind of federal income tax, a pretty huge amount of our earnings set aside to buy weapons. And, you know, I guess we just have to ask ourselves, do we want to do that?
Yeah, it's interesting. These are the things that I think are just interesting to find out about that people are doing to not participate.
For instance, I know some of the most wonderful people in the world, I think, who once they decide that they're going to unhinge themselves from the dominant culture, I guess, have found all kinds of ways to be very, very happy and live counterculturally. I know a group of young people in the Northampton area of Massachusetts. They call themselves the pedal pushers, and they've arranged to help everybody in their area with recycling by biking over to pick up people's recycling. They've got carts on the back of their bicycles, and they haul it to the local trash dump, and they are engaged in organic gardening and helping with cooperative ways to distribute food and pull food out of the ground themselves. They're trying their best to go off the grid as much as possible, use solar power, and they're healthy and happy and very vital people, extremely well informed. I mean, I think it shouldn't be seen as people who inflict misery on themselves. Believe me, I wouldn't have been able to stay with these kinds of efforts for decades if it was a miserable option in life. Warfare is depraved and miserable, and when you're in a war zone, there's nothing that can alleviate the sense of utter despair that humanity has come to this. So let me add that. But I certainly don't think that the effort to live in it, you know, that refusing to be dominated by the national religion, which is shopping in this country, is going to make people vastly unhappy. I think we could all have much better quality of life, really, if we felt that we were taking control over our life.
And that is where Skype cut us off for the second time. I could have made that a little smoother, but we had to totally start anew. So editing it would have been clumsy at best. So I decided that through the magic of podcasting, and since we get away with these things in the world of podcasting, that I'll let you hang waiting for the next bit. If you have feedback about this show, please send it to MikeyPod@gmail.com, and I will put the information and links to all of the websites that Kathy mentioned so far in the interview today. Tune in probably Thursday. I think Thursday or Friday I'll put up the second half, or hell, tomorrow. I'm really excited about this, so maybe it'll go up tomorrow. A voicemail, 206-339-6682. I really would love to have your feedback. And if you would, spread the word about this podcast, because I think this is some information about the effects of our country's policies that we don't all know about, and we really need to. So look at the show notes at MikeyPod.com for links to all of the websites that she talked about. Tomorrow's half of the episode talks more about some possible things to do if you do want to take action. And we got into some talk about spirituality and Christianity, and it's just fascinating. I was so thrilled to have been able to do this interview, and I look forward to sharing the rest of it with you. And that'll be it for today. I'm going to play geez. See how I am? Oh, God. I'm so shaken up. What's it called? I'm going to sit here and figure it out, too. A PSA, public service announcement from the Green Party, which was done by my pal, Susie. This is also played on KPFT. She's the secretary for the Green Party, and we may have her on the show soon, too. So with that, I say goodbye to you. Look forward to the next episode to be out this week.
Calling all volunteers. The Harris County Green Party is kicking off the 2006 ballot access drive, and we need you. Due to Texas election statutes, the Green Party needs to gather 75,000 signatures to gain access to the Texas ballot. If you support grassroots democracy, then call us at 713-866-6285 or sign up on our webpage at www.hcgp.org. The Harris County Green Party needs your help with calling potential signature gatherers, fundraising, and most importantly, getting out there and gathering signatures on the Green Party petition for Texas ballot access. Call 713-866-6285 or visit us at our website at www.hcgp.org. Join us, volunteer, and make it happen.
You've been listening to Mikey Pod on the Bayou with Michael Herron. Mikey wants your input to the show. Do you have a comment about something that was said on the show? A review or a promotion of a cultural event, especially in the Houston area? Or you just want to say hi? Email is MikeyPod@gmail.com. The Mikey Pod Show hotline, 206-339-6682. And record it down for all to hear. See you next time right here for Mikey Pod on the Bayou. MikeyPod.com.